Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network, and a big thanks to Melinda Myers for joining us as well on the phone. Nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, she's an author, columnist, over 30 years of horticulture experience. She's written over 20 gardening books and has lots of advice and information on her website. Take a look at it. It's melindamyers.com. We'll talk to her today about the benefits of recycling those fall leaves. We'll talk planting bulbs and take your gardening questions. So I hope you'll join in the conversation. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Melinda Myers, welcome back.
Hey, thanks so much, Larry. Always a pleasure.
Well, I'll tell you what, the lawnmower is going to be coming out for me this weekend at some point, not to mow the lawn so much as to take care of the leaves. Is that, if you recommend that, is that a good idea?
You bet. You know, instead of raking them off, and especially to the curb, I had to stop the other day. I was in Milwaukee, and somebody had a pile of leaves in the street higher than my car. And I just kept thinking, this is such a valuable resource. Keep it on your lawn. So you're right. Get out the mower. It's a lot easier than raking. As long as those leaf pieces are the size of a quarter or smaller, and you can see the leaf blades for the leaf debris, your lawn will be fine. Now, some people, especially if you have big oak leaves or maple leaves, those bigger leaves don't hurt your plants, but they break down slowly. So it's really important to shred those, all the leaves up, so that they're smaller size. And you may need to do a couple passes to get them down to that level. And I never use a bagger on my mower except when I'm dealing with leaves. And so, you know, shredding them, collecting them in the bagger, and then using them as a mulch on the soil, or bagging them and saving them for next year, you know, tuck them behind your foundation plantings for added insulation in our Wisconsin winters, or add them to your compost pile. Or if you're worried about the butterflies, and a lot of us are trying to protect the pollinators, I have lots of toads on my property. So whole leaves, if you have areas where you've got leaves in the garden, but they're not on top of the plants because they don't make a good winter mulch, especially when they get wet and icy, they can really cause some problems with your perennials if they're over top. But in between the plants, they do provide insulation. They're great mulch, and they also insulate those insects that are overwintering, maybe in the leaf litter or underground. Like the toads go deep in the ground, in the soil, but if we have a layer of leaves, that's going to keep it a little bit more moderate, so we increase the chance of them being happy and healthy through the winter and coming back and eating more bugs in our garden.
You know what? Mason in Eau Claire has a question that relates to all this. So
okay.
let's go there. Mason, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a couple maple trees on my property, but they do have the black spots all over them.
Tar spot.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I can use those leaves or if I need to get rid of them just so that the spores don't spread.
Yeah, so this is, you know, Brian Huddleston, the UW Extension plant pathologist, Dr. Death, as he often calls himself, good friend and such a great expert we're lucky to have in this state. He would recommend that you get rid of them, bury them some way if you have an ability to burn them or send them to the landfill or somewhere else. When I lived in the city of Milwaukee, all our maple street trees had tar spot, including the one in front of my house, the park across the street, and the easement next to me. And I'm sure Brian is cringing right now if he hears me say this. I shredded them and left them on my lawn. I thought, you know, the difference I'm going to make. Now, he would disagree, so I want to give him credit. He is the expert. But I was the lazy homeowner that said, there's no way I'm going to take advantage of them. But if you have space to bury them somewhere, an option, you're going to reduce the amount of that disease present. So that is the positive. I was looking at it as organic matter, and I can't beat this one, so I'm going. So I didn't really answer your question, Mason. I'm giving you two viewpoints for you to decide.
Yeah, they just, I follow your approach, Melinda, when it comes to the, I don't have any maples, but a lot of my neighbors do, and so I've got tar spot leaves in my lawn, and I gave up on that.
I did too. So, Brian, my apologies. I did give your advice, and then I took the lazy gardener approach that Larry and I seem to both be doing. Sorry, Brian.
There you go, Mason. Well, you know, as long as Gary and Iron River's been waiting a bit, let's go there. Gary, hi, with a different question.
Folks, I have a question about my clematis or clematis. I bought a bush-style root this spring, and where I want to put it permanently wasn't ready, so I put it in a pot that's about 1 cubic foot square. It's still in that pot. I'm wondering how to store it best. Can I just leave it outside? Or I have a garage that's heated to 40 degrees, and I have another garage that gets down, not heated, but it's attached, so it gets down to 30 or so in the coldest part of the winter. What's my best option?
I'm so glad you asked, Gary, because a lot of people are in that boat. I have some things that still need to get in the ground and some that probably won't get in the ground. And I have good success overwintering in my unheated garage because we want your clematis to go dormant. Outside, those roots are going to be exposed to the extreme temperatures, and that small volume of soil doesn't really provide the same insulation as plants get when their roots are in ground. So one of the key things I find is I'll put some of the things that are bored, you know, if it's a zone 5, I'm zone 5-4 where I live now. So if I have a plant that's a zone 5 that may be borderline, I put it against the wall next to my house and somewhat protected from when the door goes open. I'll often sit my pot inside a box and maybe put some insulation around the roots just for added protection if I'm worried it's going to get too cold. But I would move it into your unheated garage. The heated garage, it might start growing, and these plants need to get dormant. You won't have enough light to keep them, to support them. So your unheated garage, water whenever the soil is thawed and dry. That's where I really find people lose their plants. You know, we get that winter thaw sometimes in February or March. The temperatures get high, the garage gets warm, the soil thaws, and the roots dry out. And that's usually what kills them. It's not the cold of winter in your unheated garage. So just make a mental note that if we get a warm spell, check the soil if it's thawed and dry. When I lived in the city, I used to laugh because I was a crazy garden lady, and I'd be carrying my watering can out to the garage, you know, and I'm sure the neighbors wondered. And then the smarter gardener than me said, well, I just take a scoop of snow, not with no de-icing salt. You don't want to add any de-icing salt. But when she's shoveling those areas that don't have de-icing salt, she'd throw a scoop on every plant. So when it got dry, warm, and dry, it watered the plant. I thought, what a smart idea. And her neighbors really thought she was crazy, so added benefit.
And, you know, if you don't put them, put it in a box, you should at least set it on a board or something so the bottom of the pot isn't in contact with the cement floor.
Thank you, Larry. I'm glad you caught that. Absolutely right. You want to make sure to get that insulation layer. Good point. Thank you.
Gary, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Somebody wondered if it's okay to plant trees and shrubs yet. I guess it might be. I don't know.
Well, it depends on how far north they are. I know many in Minnesota and probably parts of northern Wisconsin, you may not be able to get to the soil. Fall is a great time to plant. The roots continue to grow until the soil really starts freezing. I'm hoping it's good because I have some shrubs and bulbs to get in the ground. So you're absolutely right, Larry. If you're in the far north, you may be packed up for the season. Those of us in the central and southern part of Wisconsin are banking, at least if you're like me, banking on having some more time. The temperatures in parts of the state are supposed to be pretty warm for the next few days. And I'm going to try to take advantage of that and get those things in the ground. So, you know, you'll want to be able to dig a proper hole, you know, take advantage of the milder weather, because if you're comfortable, you'll do a better job planting. You know, obviously, once the ground's frozen, you know, I have some friends in the business who have used pickaxes to kind of break through that top frost. But I'm hoping I'm not that desperate this year.
Okay. Well, John in Belleville has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I thought I heard earlier you had mentioned that, you know, just using a mower to break up some of the leaves and then put it on top of the garden. I'm just wondering if I do that, if we have a lot of leaves in our yard, but then we also have grass clippings that's mixed in with that. If I put all of that on top of the garden, is that okay, or do those grass clippings affect it?
You know, great question. Now, if you have not treated with a weed killer, then that's fine. And actually, that's a great mix because those grass clippings provide nitrogen. The leaves are a source of carbon. That makes them a great addition to the compost pile or a mulch. And just, I want to make sure I was clear, too, just on the soil, not over top of your perennials, but around your plantings on the soil. And that grass clippings, as long as they're free from weed killers, you know, if you didn't do a weed and feed, you know, a few weeks ago, then you're fine. If you did do a weed and feed a few weeks ago, you might want to rake some of those leaves into a pile out of your lawn. Some people will rake them onto maybe a deck or a bare part of the garden and then use their mower to shred them. I have some leaf shredders, and I find that, boy, I found my mower to be the most effective. You know,
yeah.
They seem to deal with the leaves the best. So, yes, you could use those grass clippings. I just want to put a plug in for Fresh Coast Guardians, because one of the reasons I like to keep leaves on the landscape is to keep them out of our waterways. You know, I understand why people rake them to the curb. It always seems to rain, right? And then they plug up the storm sewer. The city has to come clean those out. And all those nutrients are going into our waterway instead of on our landscape. So I just had to put a plug in for Fresh Coast Guardians and keeping water where it falls, because that's a great resource that we really can put to good use. So, John, no weed killer. You're free to use those in your lawn, in your landscape. All
right. Oh, we may have...
Hello?
Oh, yeah, are you there? Are you there?
I am.
I thought I lost you there for a minute, Melinda.
Okay.
But you're free to go with that, John. You heard it from the expert, Melinda Myers. Great to have Melinda with us today. Of course, nationally known gardening expert. By the way, you've got some free gardening webinars that you've been offering. Talk about that for a minute, will you?
You bet. You know, I think we're all missing those in-person opportunities, and I'm always looking for ways to reach out to gardeners and share ideas and information I've learned along the way and pass it along. And American Transmission Company has been kind enough to sponsor a series of, it's either 8 or 9 webinars. I just did the last one they sponsored Wednesday on hydrangea problems, but we're leaving them on my website on demand through the end of the year. So if you didn't join me in the past, the American Transmission Company sponsored webinars are going to be available through December. Just go to the appearance page on my website. And then We Energies was kind enough to sponsor 2 more. So on November 11th, I'm going to give you tips on forcing bulbs indoors. So if you bought spring flowering bulbs and the ground is too cold or you're tired of gardening, I got tips for you, as well as forcing amaryllis and paperwhites. And then the following week, November 18th, I've got some tips on selecting and caring for holiday plants. And so just, you know, you buy that poinsettia, that mum, that cyclamen, and they never seem to last. Or maybe they do, but you're looking for some new ideas. I'm going to share that on November 11th. And I want to thank We Energies for sponsoring those two, so I can stay in touch with gardeners. It's been a lot of fun. I had to laugh when we lost connection because technology is always an adventure. And you're a pro at this. Me, not so much. So hopefully folks will join me.
Tyler Ditter, our engineer, is the pro.
Okay.
He kind of keeps me going here. So I'm that sounds like a lot of fun. And again, your website, melindamyers.com, right?
You bet. And so all the appearances past and future are on there, and then there's links. You do need to register, but it's free, and I have a handout as well. So if you're doing, if you look at the past ones, there's a link for a downloadable handout. And the nice part about doing this virtually is I can have a handout that's 5 pages long with links and lots more information than when I'm speaking in person and have to keep it front to back on one page. So I've tried to beef up the information. So you actually have a guide as well as a handout to go with my talk.
Sounds perfect. Melinda Myers, our guest today, great to have her with us. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden and lawn today with Melinda Myers, nationally known gardening expert. Always great to have her come by. Her website, melindamyers.com. And by the way, we have a link on our website to those free webinars as well. So if you didn't get all that, you can just go to the ideas@WPR.org/Larry and look in the program notes, and there they will be. Greg in Oregon, it's your turn now. Hi, Greg.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. As they say, thank you for taking my call. Listen, I was wondering, my grass in the backyard is just tremendously lush, green, and it's about 3.5 inches tall. I think my question was fairly well answered when she spoke about grinding them up with the lawnmower. So is it good, or should I wait till spring to mow my lawn?
You know, you can continue to mow high, but if you do have leaves on top, I'm looking at our grass weed collection out here. We've got kind of, it's green, but it looks like we're going to have to mow again, and I mow pretty high. So even if you just mow to cut up your leaves and your lawn's shorter than what you're mowing, it will be fine. So if you don't have leaves on there, you know, keeping that at 3.5 inches for the winter, you don't need to go shorter. A lot of people choose to do that. But, you know, if you want to keep it at that height for winter, that's fine. And if you chop up some leaves along the way, that's great, too. Now, if your lawn's really thick and lush and you're seeing the leaves form a layer on top, then you might need to think about bagging them or raking them off and getting them out of the way, because you do want to make sure when there's no snow on your grass that the light can get through and that those leaves, especially big leaves, you know, block the sunlight and trap the moisture. So we need to get them off the land, off the lawn if they're in whole pieces. So I hope that helps, Greg.
Yeah. Thank you, Greg, for calling. Appreciate it. Philip in Trempealeau, it's your turn. Hi, Philip.
Hi. I have a lot of leaves. I have a oak tree in my front yard that's almost 90 feet in its canopy. And then I have black walnuts and maples. And I take those and put them into my wooded hillside. Is there anything you can seed those piles of leaves that I have to break them down faster?
You know, a great point. And one of the reasons I recommend shredding leaves when we're using them in certain areas because they break down faster. You know, in the woods, you'll see that a lot of, it's not as dense. Part of that's the shade from the forest trees, and part of it's the leaf cover. Don't let me forget to talk about black walnut, and I know you won't, Larry, because I forgot to mention that earlier. You know, if you feel you need to speed up the process, adding some fertilizer could help. You know, I've got to disclose, I work with Milorganite, but was a fan before I started. It's a low nitrogen, slow release, so it's not going to interfere much. If you shred the leaves before you rake them in, that's going to, you know, speed up the decomposition. Again, the leaf cover is great for, so if you left the whole leaves under that are on the existing forest and topped them off with those shredded leaves from the lawn, you should still be helping all those beneficial insects that may be hovering in that leaf litter. And then by shredding them, you're speeding up the process. Black walnuts, and I'm glad you brought that up, Philip. Black walnuts contain juglone, in all parts of the black walnut tree, the leaves, the nuts, the husk, the roots, and they're toxic to some plants. It can stunt some, it can kill others. And so those are leaves that you want to be careful where you spread them. If you compost them, once they're totally decomposed, they won't be a problem. If you have a lot of black walnut leaves, you might even want to have a separate compost pile so that you make sure you wait till they're fully decomposed, because if you use black walnut leaves as a mulch around susceptible plants, that can damage them or even kill them, stunt or kill them. So you want to make sure they're totally decomposed before you use them around any susceptible plants. But, Philip, I think if shredding leaves speeds the decomposition, and then you might want to just add, but I'd just go with either an organic or like a mulorganite that has organic matter, 85%, and very low nitrogen will help feed the microorganisms to speed up the breakdown if you've got really big piles.
There you go, Philip. Thank you very much for calling. And Kay in Prairie du Chien, your turn.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was just calling about the black walnut tree leaves and their stems. Plus, I have locust trees, which have five walnut trees and two locust trees. And not only are they wonderfully messy and hard to keep up with, but I was wondering, I usually rake them. I have a sweeper, lawn sweeper, and I usually sweep them up, pile them, and then get rid of them. But I was wondering if I was to shred those with the lawn mower, plus the husks from the walnut, I found if I put the husks in a container and cover them with, like if or let rainwater get in there and then cover them and leave them set until spring, they ferment. I put them on Creeping Charlie in a section just to try to see if it would work, and it really knocked the heck out of them. It really did.
That is good to know. And lawn grass is resistant to black walnut, so that's makes it very selective when treating it in your lawn. I thank you, Kay. This is what I love, Larry, about working with you and your listeners. I always learn something new. It sounds like you know how to manage the black walnuts. And just for anybody, you know, I grew up, my dad, we had black walnuts on my grandma's property. My dad, I think it was his stress relief, would be in the basement all winter cracking the nuts open. But you always want to wear gloves when you're dealing with the husk, because that's where the stain, you'll end up with brown hands. Again, the same caution would be with the stems. You're right, the rachis or the leaf stem on those big leaves of both the locust and the black walnut do break down slowly. The black walnut, all parts are toxic, and it sounds like you know that, Kay. I just want to emphasize for people not familiar. And, yeah, I think if you shred them, I'm not sure. I haven't tried it with the mower if they're so fine that you'll have good success. My other shredder that I do have good success with is a barrel shredder, and it's just like a weed whip that you throw your leaves down and it whips them. That might work. Or just throw those stems of the leaves in the bottom of your compost pile if you do compost. And that way they're at the bottom, and they may end up staying there a couple cycles of composting, but they'll eventually break down. Honestly, I haven't tried using the mower on them. I know they cause a lot of people headaches because they are very difficult to shred up and break down. So I would say give it a try. Let us know, Kay. And thanks for the tip on the black walnuts and creating your own Creeping Charlie herbicide.
I love that idea. And, you know, I don't have any black walnut trees, but I've got a squirrel who brings the black walnuts I'll find one in the corner of a step, another one on the deck. And then sometimes he breaks them open and eats them on the driveway. Those, just the most irritating thing, but I'm going to take those, Kay, and I'm following your advice, and I'm going to put them in, let them sit in water and wait till spring and see if it works. Thank you.
Thanks so much, and good luck dealing with all those leaf stems as well.
Oh, boy. Ron in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I have an old maple tree in my backyard. My dad, I think he planted it in the fall of 54. Of course, it's huge now. And I have a two-step process for mulching leaves. First, I use my leaf vac, but I don't put the catch bag on it because it's been problematic. It keeps opening up. And then after I mulch them without the bag, scatter them all over, then I go over with my lawnmower. That way the catch bag on my mower doesn't fill up as quick.
Ah, good idea.
That's a very good idea.
And, you know, one of the things I love about, I'm a gardener. I always say I'm a gardener. I'm a horticulturist, but I'm a gardener too. And gardeners are so great about sharing ways they've resolved issues. And so I love to hear how people are managing it, because, Ron, someone out there is going to go, oh, what a great idea. And I had the same problem. I had a leaf back when I was in, had my small property in the city, and it would always rain the day before I was trying to deal with my leaves, and the bag always opened, and that's when I just said, give that up in the mower. But that's a great idea, especially with people with large quantities of leaves. And I don't know if we got cut off, Larry, when I gave a plug for Fresh Coast Guardians, but they've got lots of tips on not only managing leaves, but other ways to keep water on the landscape. So I wanted to give them a plug, freshcoastguardians.com. Just, you know, I think if we work together, we can keep our waterways cleaner. And water is what Wisconsin's about, right? We have great lakes and rivers, and we depend on them for enjoyment and tourism and to drinking as well.
Yeah, for sure. You know, another question relating to leaves comes from Craig in Cedarburg. He emailed to ask, what's the maximum depth of leaves that can be mulched on the lawn? Also, same for the garden.
You know, great question, Craig. So the key to, for what I always look for is when I look at the lawn, can I see the majority of the leaf, you know, or the grass blades? You should be able to see those through the leaf debris. You know, you've chopped it up, and those finer pieces are going to drop between the leaf blades. And so, you know, when Greg called and said he had a really lush lawn, he's probably going to be able to get less leaves on there because he's got such a dense stand than somebody whose lawn is a little thinner. So you need to be able to see the grass blades for the leaf pieces. On your gardens, you know, a couple of inches, 2 or 3 inches, if they're shredded, the finer the mulch, the thinner the layer you need because they net in. But if you do a couple inches, and they'll settle over winter, I'll tell you, leaves are my favorite garden mulch. I try to mulch throughout the season, but I find if I have leaf mulch down, I have fewer weeds to pull when spring comes around and throughout the growing season. So, you know, a couple inches in the garden. You could even shred some and dig them into your annual flower beds, especially those of you with heavy clay or even sandy soil. You know, shredding the leaves, they break down quickly. Dig them into those new or annual flower and vegetable gardens, and as they break down over winter, they add organic matter to the soil. So that's another way to put them to use. And again, depending on where you live, it may be a little late if your soil is already covered with snow or pretty crunchy. But we've got some warm weather ahead, so it might not be such a bad idea for those of us that still have some time to get those leaves in our annual beds. It'll help improve the soil and put these to work in your landscape.
You know, Adam in Deerfield has a related question, so let's go there. Adam, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We use leaves in all our garden beds, lots and lots of leaves, and we have lots of trees as well. And we have so many gardens that we're actually, we don't have enough leaves. So I contacted a nearby neighbor to bring us all the leaves that they are getting and collecting. We're talking those big, huge trailers, and we're probably going to get everything we can get. My concern is that they're not going to be chipped up as much as what we do. What I generally do with my mower is I mow over it, kind of create a row, and once the bag is full, and then I just keep mowing over it. That way it's chipping it up, and then I'll empty that initial bag and then go back and suck everything up that's nice and chipped up, and I've created some nice rows. But I'm wondering, with this large quantity of leaves that we have coming, if they're not chipped up that much, if you think like a tree chipper, I'm going to need something huge to get through that many leaves. I don't know if like a tree chipper might be able to get through.
Oh, a wood chipper.
Yeah, what I found is with the wood chippers, especially if your leaves are wet, I really found it wasn't as successful. Like I said, I have a barrel shredder that seems to handle a little bit better, but we ended up, I had purchased leaves and they were supposed to be 3 times shredded, but they were wet and they were pretty much whole. And I'm doing, you know, raking them, mowing them, bagging them, and it was taking too long. And it's an investment, but we bought a larger vacuum shredder. You know, it has a big chute, and we've, you know, I'm on 11 acres now, so it's different than my city lot. And so we were able, it was kind of that vacuum sucker idea that, that Ron suggested he uses his leaf vac. Well, this is kind of a king size one. And I found it really worked well. And then it's on a trailer. So I don't know how big your property, sounds like you might have property. And so it sucks it in. It's gas powered, so you don't need any. It's not electric, but we suck them up. It fills the trailer. It's huge. It's probably 3 by 3 by 3 area, and I can drive it into the garden, dump it at the end of the garden beds, and it works great. I don't know if any place rents those. You know, you might want to check. I've tried small-scale chippers. I have a larger wood chipper, but I just find with the leaf material, it does work, but you might be able to rent one of those easier than this vacuum, this leaf vacuum that we ended up purchasing, and that works great for us. The one thing I do want to mention, so I'm so glad you brought up getting leaves from other people or commercial places. The concern is about jumping worms, and I know you guys have covered this topic, Larry. Jumping worms are invasive worms, large. They eat large quantities of organic matter. Our concern is them getting into our natural areas and even destroying the soil structure in our garden beds. And so I've been very hesitant. I used to get leaves from somebody, and then I've been a little hesitant lately because I have some woods on the back end of my property, and I certainly don't want to be spreading jumping worms. And so if leaves are vacuumed up and collected, there is a chance that those could come with them. So if you're, you know, maybe talk to your friends, see if they're aware of jumping worms. Are they seeing issues? You know, depending on how they collect them, the jumping worms should be, the adults die over winter. They overwinter as cocoons and eggs that are very tiny. But there is some concern that you want to be careful about getting plant material of any kind from other people.
And so, somebody's already... Yeah, and somebody's already wondering, what was the name of again of that unit that you use that for that larger?
You know, and I'm with a wonderful guy that always deals with equipment, and I think we purchased it, and I'm not giving them, I don't work with them, but I think it was just a leaf vacuum, a commercial size or pro leaf vacuum, and okay. It has a 6-inch diameter hose. And you can suck it up, and it's. And he bought it at, I'm sure, at Northern Tools. I don't work with them; it's not a plug for them. But that might be a place. I will get the name of it, Larry, and get it to you right after we're off the air. So if you wouldn't mind posting it, so people can find it on your website.
We will definitely post it.
I will get it. Has worked really well. Well, it came about because he saw me doing the rake, mow, load, take a little. And he's like, there's got to be an easier way.
Okay. All right. We'll post that up on our page once we get it from Melinda. So there you go. And Adam, thank you again for your question. Nancy in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good morning. I have a couple of beautiful mums in planters. Can I plant those, and would they last over the winter, or should I just say adios when they freeze out?
So did you plant them? You bought them this fall to decorate and place in your planters? Is that, or did you? Yeah, okay.
They already were in the planters when I bought them.
Oh, okay. So they're in pots. Okay.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. Garden mums are hardy. The problem is when we get them in the fall, they've been forced to bloom. So all the energy is going into the flowers instead of developing a good, strong root system. And my thought is, if I've got them and I want to give it a try, I have nothing to lose because they're going to die in the pot above ground. So you could try overwintering them in an unheated garage. I've had some success with that, just like we were talking about before. I have planted some. Sometimes they make it, sometimes they don't. Leave them stand for winter if you put them in the garden. Then after the ground freezes, you know, after Christmas, if you get a live Christmas tree, a cut Christmas tree, fresh tree, cut some of those branches and cover the plant for added insulation, and then wait and see if they make it. My favorite mum, when I want mums to survive in my garden, they used to be, my favorite mum was the brand name. Now they're sold as Mammoth Mum. and they were bred in Minnesota, University of Minnesota, hardy, I think, for sure to zone 4, possibly 3. No winter protection needed. I leave them stand for winter. In the spring, I prune them back, the dead material, and new growth comes, and they're loaded with flowers. They're big mums, but that might be an option. Or a lot of garden centers sell their garden mums in spring, so we can get them in the ground, get them rooted, and then enjoy the flowers, and it increases the chance of success. But you know what, Nancy, I'm all about, part of gardening is pushing the limits, right? And if you're
right.
if you're successful, you tell your friends what a good gardener you are. And if not, you grew them as an annual. You didn't fail. So
there you go. Oh, man. Thank you, Nancy, for calling. Rod in Arlington has something for us. Hi, Rod.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You were talking about a lawn vac setup. My neighbor, well, you can get him at Farm and Fleet and Fleet
okay.
Farm. It hooks to your mower deck so that it mows and chops, and then the vac sucks them up into the cart. And the cart is about 3 by 5 by 4 or 5 tall. It hauls a whole bunch,
yeah.
And it's the problem is it's a very dusty, dirty situation when it's dry to unload it. So he just purchased last year a unit he found in Indiana. This thing will handle about 4 times what that other one will, and it just is a pull behind. You got to have a fairly good-sized compact tractor, but you pull it behind, it sucks them all up. It's got a little roller set up on it that sweeps everything up, sucks them in. The nice part about it is it's hydraulically operated with a separate motor like the other one is, but when you get full, all you have to do is back up to the pile and pull a lever. It opens like a clamshell. You drive away, it's empty, and you go back to work. And
that sounds like the one we have because it's separate. It's not hooked up to our mower. We pull it behind. We just can pull it with our, you know, four-wheel vehicle or golf cart, and it does. It opens, and it's great. So thank you for that. So that one he bought, maybe we need your link, too, so people can know where to look for various options.
Yeah. Rod, what was the name of what it, you broke up a little bit right at the naming.
Oh, of the large unit?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, for the life of me, I can't think of it right now.
Okay.
What I can tell you is it's large, very large and orange, and it stands about 6.5 feet tall. But it does an amazing job, and you don't have to. You can windrow everything in and go through with that and save yourself a lot of going over the whole complete yard. You just got to watch tree limbs that are on the lower side on some of your trees.
Rod,
perfect.
Thank you so much for calling. Melinda Myers, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great to have back Melinda Myers, our nationally known gardening expert. It's always fun to have her come by. And if you want to take a look at her website, it is melindamyers.com. Melindamyers.com. Lots of great information there as well. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. And Melinda, let's take a few emails here. John in Madison emailed that in September he planted trillium, the snow trillium bulbs, under a quarter inch wire mesh covered with leaves to protect the plants from squirrels or chipmunks. When he removes the wire mesh prior to the time when they're supposed to emerge in early to mid-March, will the squirrels attack after the wire mesh is removed and they smell human activity in the area? If so, is there anything he can do to protect the bulbs at this point?
Yeah, who knows? My guess is after all your efforts, I'd probably want to protect them just to be sure. I've had some really good success. I do work with Plant Skid. It's an organic animal repellent. It's rain and snow resistant, so that means it lasts longer, so you're not reapplying it. And any repellent you choose, if you can treat that area before the plants start to emerge. Hopefully the bulbs should be fine. The bulbous part should be fine underground. You know, as they're starting to grow, that's when you're going to remove the wire mesh, and that's when I would treat them with any whatever plant repellent you think will work or choose. But I've had good success with PlantSkid because I don't have to put it on as often, and it manages a lot of those different pests. And so I would treat them at least this first year just to make sure. I'm not sure if the squirrels will go after them, but, boy, I wouldn't want to take a chance after you work so hard to get them in the ground and protect them over winter.
Absolutely. Dora in La Crosse called to ask if she could overwinter her artichoke plants, and if so, how?
Dora, I have to tell you a funny story. So I grow artichokes, and I harvested maybe 6 this year. So it's one of those things to be able to, I have to tell you I did it, so I feel better about the expense and the time. They're beautiful plants. One year, I've tried twice to overwinter them, and I'm not this year because every year I've tried using row covers and mulch to overwinter them. It drops to 14 degrees, so I'm going to give us all a break, and I'm not going to do it. I think trying it in your unheated garage may be the option. These things, the Imperial Star artichoke blooms in the first year. You need to start them early. I plant mine out. I buy transplants. I plant mine out when I do my tomatoes, and I've had pretty good success with getting some chokes. And if you don't harvest the chokes, they have flowers that, and then they're in the thistle family. It might be too cold in your unheated garage because artichokes typically spend their winters in places like Southern California. I think it's worth a shot. I might just, you've motivated me, Dora. Maybe I'll dig up a couple and we'll have to compare notes come next summer. I have figs right now that were loaded with fruit, and I've been trying to protect them from this cold, hoping that they'll have time to mature. I harvested 2. But, you know, there's a lot. It's like your tomatoes, right? You'll see all those unripe tomatoes. So you might want to try row cover if they're in the ground. Digging them up might be stressful, but, it's worth a try. If you have a cool spot in your basement where it's dark so that you keep them kind of like you would a geranium or mandevilla or some of those things that you keep dormant, somewhat dormant, that might be another place to try so they don't grow, but they're not exposed to freezing temperatures. If you have a couple, maybe try a few different places and let us know what works for you.
Absolutely. And speaking about digging up, a listener in Southwest Wisconsin emailed to ask if it's too late to dig up false sunflower plants to separate the roots and transplant to a new location, Southwest Wisconsin.
You know, you probably can get by with it. The old theory, the old saying is that blooms in spring, transplant late summer, early fall. If it blooms in fall, transplant in the spring. If it blooms in summer, either time. But as gardeners, we know we transplant when we have time. And, you know, the thing I would do, though, if you do transplant it now, you know, make sure it gets sufficient moisture so those roots are going to be, you know, they're going to be putting down new roots. And then once the ground freezes, I would mulch it this year, even though it's a reliably hardy plant. You know, you're moving it so late that once the ground freezes, our goal is to keep that soil frozen so it doesn't freeze and thaw and the plant frost heaves or pushes right out of the soil. And so I would put that as a priority to mulch if you move it now.
John in Sterling, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi.
How
what can we
help?
Do for
Hello.
You?
Oh, God. Can you mow off asparagus, and can you mow off peonies? And there's one other kind, I can't think of the name of the flower. It begins with an A, and it gets nice big blue blooms around Memorial Day. Can you mow those off? And if so, when can you mow them off? Do you have to wait till they're turned brown, or can you mow them off anytime?
Great questions. So with asparagus, if you haven't had problems with asparagus beetles, you want to wait till the tops are yellow and brown and get rid of them. Otherwise, I like to leave the tops stand for winter. They help capture snow, insulate the roots, and then do my cleanup in spring. For peonies, we've had such a big problem with powdery mildew on peonies. That's one that I would clean up. If you've had problems with powdery mildew, it looks like someone sprinkled baby powder over the leaves of your plant, I would cut that back to the ground once the leaves are brown. Mine, I had powdery mildew this year, so I'm going to get out this weekend. Should have gone out earlier. Cut them back and get rid of those. Bury them off to another area and away from that planting. So Roy Diblick, who wrote the book No, K-N-O-W Maintenance, is a big, he's really done a lot with mowing down gardens. He does a lot of mix of cultivated of native plants and mowing them down and leaving the debris, chopping it up as small as possible and leaving the debris in the garden. I'm a fan of doing that as late in the late winter, early spring as possible, because we have a lot of pollinators that overwinter in many of our grasses and perennials, especially those with hollow stems. And so by waiting as long as possible, we give them a chance to break out of their winter homes and go find their summer lodging. And so if I was going to do it, I like to see this stuff stand for the winter. I know some people consider it messy. You could do it in the fall, but the benefit of leaving it over winter is winter interest. Some of them have seeds the birds eat, and they really add to our winter landscape. And again, they're homes for many of our pollinators. So if you can wait till with your healthy plants, now anything diseased, get it out of the garden. But I wouldn't mow it. I'd get it out of the garden, because if you chop it up, some of those disease organisms are going to be left in the garden, and they'll infect your plants next year. So healthy plants, if you can tolerate the way they look, I think it's beautiful. I know not everybody does.
I like it.
Leaving them stand for winter, you know, is a good option for a lot of things. And then take care of them as late in the season as you can. One thing the more research I did on pollinators and plants is I kept finding later and later that they were in the hollow stems, and the longer we can wait, and somebody even recommended June. Well, I like winter interest, but not in June. So I talked to P.J. Leash, our UW Extension entomologist. So I hope you're okay, P.J., I'm quoting you here. And I said, what if I cut them back, pile them out of the way, and then chop them up later after I'm sure everybody left? And he thought that might be a good compromise. You know, if I don't want to look at it in June, if I cut things back, pile them out of sight, out of mind, and then midsummer chop them up and use them either as mulch or in my compost pile. So that's, I have room now. So that's a strategy that's working for me.
Paul in Mesa, Maine will give you a chance. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a rose tree. You know, one stem up and then bushes on the top and that.
Right.
And we left it in the pot. We just dug a hole, set it, because the lady we bought it from said we could do that, and then bring it in the house in the wintertime. But at some point, do I have to put it in an unheated garage so it can go dormant?
You know, roses can grow all year. I mean, they're in areas where it doesn't really get cold. The problem is bringing them inside, getting enough light. Spider mites often have attack those plants just because the air is dry. The light intensity is a lot less than outside, so the plants are struggling. The insects are thriving. And so if you've ever tried to grow even just one of those miniature roses on your windowsill, they can struggle just because the growing conditions aren't great. You don't need to make it go dormant. If you do bring it inside, you might want to consider adding a plant light just to boost that light intensity so that it is doing okay in the winter. It's not necessarily going to look as good as it does outside, but that just might put it over the edge to keep it healthy, less susceptible to insect problems, and in better shape to go back over. Rose trees are grafted. Typically, there's a graft at the top where that bushy part occurs, and a graft, depending on the rose, sometimes grafted at the bottom. And so some people will have good success overwintering them in an unheated garage, again, watering when the soil's thawed and dry. As Larry mentioned, put a board underneath. You might want to insulate the roots. You might even want to wrap the plant if your garage gets really cold. But if you bring it in the house, I would consider, if you're not putting it in a dark spot and having it go dormant, but in a window, I would consider adding some extra light just to give it that boost and get it through the winter before you put it back outside.
There you go, Paul. Thank you so much. Eric emailed to say that he likes to use a weed trimmer to cut up his leaves. He puts them in a pile or in a steel barrel.
I always am nervous about recommending that. Eric, thank you, because I know a lot of gardeners do, and that's what my barrel shredder looks like. I just always worry if something goes wrong, they'll blame me. So that was, that wasn't me, but I understand, Eric. Other gardeners are doing it with great success. Just safety glasses whenever you're shredding, whether it's a DIY or equipment. I mean, just be safe. We want you to be have all your fingers, your eyes, you know, those things start flying out. You want to be careful. But thank you, Eric. That's a suggestion I've heard from many gardeners.
And Brett emailed to say it's on the rake. It's called a cyclone rake, he said.
Oh, okay. The device that his neighbor...
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, good to know.
Good to know. Our guest today, Melinda Myers, nationally known gardening expert. Go to her website at melindamyers.com, and you'll see all kinds of things about her gardening, her free gardening webinars as well. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for being with us today. And thanks, too, to Melinda Myers, our guest, nationally known gardening expert, TV radio host, author, and columnist. And ready to answer your gardening questions. What do you have in mind? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go back to the phones, and Tom in Bloomington, it's your turn. Tom, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, good afternoon. I've been picking up leaves on my rural property, a large lawn, 4 or 5 acres, with many, many older oak trees and maple trees, walnuts. I've been picking up leaves for probably 40 years on this property. And I have used all sorts of machines and equipment and expensive things to move and pick those things up every fall, try to take them out to a clearing we own on our 26 acres and keep them out there and then use them later for our gardens. Recently, 3 or 4 years ago, my son, who works at a maintenance firm in Madison, showed me what I consider to be a brilliant, inexpensive, easy way of handling leaves. He brought out some old tarps that they use in these commercial jobs, and all they do, the guys who do this, and I started to do it, is tie these old tarps up into a knot on one end, and then you just hook them, that knotted tarp, large tarp, you know, could be 12 by 8 or larger, and then you just make windrows with your tractors or your lawn tractors, and then you go along those windrows with this tarp. And without lifting the tarp up, you just leave it on the ground. Sometimes the wind is blowing and you have to secure it a little bit. Then you just take hand blowers or regular old rakes and push them into or blow them into these tarps. And then you just haul those tarps out to a different location wherever you're going with them. In our case, a clearing that we use. And I'm telling you, this thing works so well. You don't have to, and I have made this mistake, you don't have to spend $1,000, $2,000 for this equipment that you have to maintain and keep in your barn or garage. you just haul these leaves out. Yesterday, I hauled about 7 or 8 loads out with a friend of mine who came over, and we enjoy actually doing it on a nice day. You've got a nice pile of leaves for your kids and your grandkids to jump in out in your property somewhere. And it's so much easier and, I got to just say, better than these machines in these larger lots and properties.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thank you for calling, Tom, and I know you're going to comment, Melinda.
Yeah, and one of the things I like is we've given people lots of different options, anything from, and I'm with, you know, raking is, if I'm out in the garden, I'm burning calories, and that means I can have an extra cookie for dessert. And, you know, and it is good to get outside. And so thank you for sharing that. So all of you who've called in have given lots of good ideas. Tarps are a great tool that every gardener should have. When you're transplanting, you can throw the soil on the tarp instead of in the garden bed, and then it gets mixed in with your mulch or, you know, it's an easier way for cleanup. Some gardeners in smaller lots, so, you know, for those of you in the city, throwing down a tarp and raking your leaves into the tarp so that you can drag it to wherever you want to chop them or compost them or whatever is another option, too, if you're not on, you know, the 26 acres that Tom is. So tarps are a good, handy tool, and thank you for sharing. Finding the method that works best for how you like to manage your landscape is, I think, part of the excitement and enjoyment that we have. So thank you for sharing.
Thanks, Tom. Deborah in Brown Deer, we'll go to you now. Hi, Deborah.
Hello, Larry and Melinda. This is just a joy. I live in, I'm from Upper Michigan, but I live in Brown Deer. 24 years ago, I planted a Kwanzaa cherry in the backyard, just 2 blocks north of Brown Deer Park. And it was just wonderful to watch. Every spring it was the first to bloom, beautiful pink blossoms, and then the leaves just were gorgeous in the fall. Well, about 4 years it started, it acquired a fungus, and so it died slowly, but it's got suckers. I don't know if you would call them suckers or shoots that are coming up, and they're very profuse from the base of the tree. Should I leave it or just say goodbye to the whole thing?
You know, it is so sad, and you got a long life out of that. Cherries, plums, that whole group of plants, you know, aren't typically long-lived in our area, so pat yourself on the back. You had it for a good long time to enjoy. Some of our plants are grafted, so the nursery that's propagating them seeds out, let's say, a cherry of some sort. Then they take a cutting from the Kwanzaa cherry, and they graft it onto that hardy rootstock. So if those suckers are coming from the roots that aren't the same as the top growth, you're going to have a different tree. But it might be worth picking the strongest. I would wait until spring in case you have rabbits or anything that might do a little chewing at the base of the plant. And then pick the strongest sucker if you want to get it started. And then you've got an established root system. And if it is on its own roots, then one of the nice parts is then you've got a head start. If it isn't, you're probably not going to see the same characteristics. It's too young. It may not flower for you, but you should see that nice fall color. So you might want to, you know, it might be worth a try. The worst that can happen is you decide to dig it out next spring and replace it with something else, you know. And depending on the disease, gamosis infects the vascular system, very common, but if it was something that's not translocated throughout from the roots to the top, you'd be fine. But those suckers should show some symptoms if it was the whole plant was infected. So it might be worth a fun try to do.
Sure. Give it a shot, Deborah. Thank you. Sadie in Oak Creek, it's your turn. Hi, Sadie.
Hi. I have a question because in our garden this past season, we had what we believe to be a striped cucumber beetle just start decimating, you know, our harvest and everything. And so we were just kind of concerned for next year how to prevent that or, you know, if they come back, what to do.
And when you say it does, one of the things we see with the cucumber beetles is they carry a bacterial wilt, and that's one of the reasons we really worry about controlling them, because when they feed on a plant that's got the disease and then they take it to a healthy plant, and bacterial wilt can cause your cucumbers to suddenly wilt and turn yellow and die pretty quickly. I'm never big about preventative spraying because a lot of times they don't do it doesn't do any good anyway. But what you want to do is mark your calendar. And this was advice I got from Phil Pelletier years ago, who was our UW Extension entomologist. And he said, when you have a problem, mark next year's calendar several weeks before you remember seeing that problem so you start watching for it. Because often we forget until it's too late. Oh, the population's out of control. And then you have the choice of there are some insecticides that are labeled for that. Neem is considered organic. NEEM is in Mary. It's a broad spectrum, so it kills a wide range of insects, good and bad. So we always, whether they're organic, natural, or synthetic, read and follow label directions. Some people will hand pick and throw the insects into a can of soapy water. This was on your show, Larry, years ago. I remember somebody telling me she took a little vacuum and sucked up her potato beetles and other insects. I've been looking for that gardener for years going, I want to stop and say, hey, so that might be a little quicker. You just want to make sure you don't suck up the flowers because often I find them in the flower blossom. So I hate to treat because that's where the bees are going to go that we need to pollinate. So those are some things to just start watching for them earlier. They may or may not be a problem. And hand picking, if you use an insecticide, time it when the bees aren't out there. And then you might want to try some of those, you know, a light suction from a, not a really blast from the vacuum cleaner, but, you know, maybe give that a try as well.
Thank you, Sadie, for calling. Good luck. Reggie in Oshkosh, on to you now. Hi, Reggie.
Hi there. I just had a quick question. I have a very young Japanese maple in a pot. We retransplanted it as soon as we got it to a very large pot, but I want to know if I should bring that in, put it in the garage, or put it in the ground.
You know, I had my Japanese maple when I lived in the city of Milwaukee. I had a very sheltered area, and I was not on the lake, but I was closer to the lake than I am now, and I would just put all of those plants in pots right up against my brick garage. I would surround it with my annual plants, you know, those hanging baskets of impatiens or petunias that are dead. But before I composted them, I'd surround it. So that helped insulate, maybe throw some wood chips, or when it snowed, throw the snow over it. I'm out away from the city now, and I have a kind of a few sheltered areas that I've done the same thing with some success. Your unheated garage is probably going to be the greatest chance of success. And I forgot to mention what I ended up doing, because I end up with plants every winter, is I got some 2-inch insulation pieces, and with the help of my friend Roy, I created this little framework in the garage so that they're sitting on top of insulation. So I take, you know, Larry's mm-hmm. board or something like that, and then I built kind of walls around where the pots would be, and if I don't have them totally surrounded, I shred paper to use for worm composting, and I always have more shredded paper, so I use bags of that for added insulation, and I've had really good success keeping things alive. And those are all things that if I water, they'll be okay. So you might want to, especially you're in Oshkosh, so you know you're a little bit colder than me, so I would probably move it in the unheated garage or in a protected spot minimally, and then insulate the roots as well with something, wood chips, bags, potting mix if you leave it outside.
And thanks very much for calling. Janet in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Janet.
Hi. In the summer, I bought some hens and chicks. They're in a pot, like a 4x4 pot from the nursery. And I could not decide where to actually plant them. So I rested them inside a clay pot, and they did great. And now I'm stuck with, what do I do? Like your previous caller, can I bring them in, or do I need to get them in the ground, or is there another option for winter?
I was only laughing, Janet, because I've done the same thing. I can't decide, and then it gets to be October, November. What do I do now? So that was the reason I was laughing. If you heard me chuckling, I was thinking, yep, been there. The one thing, and I've tried overwintering hens and chicks indoors, and they can be grown indoors, but they do need good bright light, cooler conditions, and drier soil. So that would be one option. With a clay pot, I worry about the ground freezing, because when that moisture, when water freezes, it expands, and clay pots absorb some moisture too. So you may end up cracking the pot. So that's one concern. So you might want to either bring it inside, try to put it in the sunniest location in a cool location in your house. That's going to be probably the trickiest. The next thing would be the unheated garage. Or if you don't mind transplanting it back into a plastic pot and sink that pot into a vacant area in the garden, that works really well. And that's one thing we haven't talked about for overwintering containers. If you have spare space, like your vegetable garden, you know, dig a trench, set those pots, you know, the grow pots. You don't want to put your good containers in the ground, but your grow pots, cover them with soil. That's going to give them the insulation they need. Then in the spring, you can lift them up and take them out. I have done clay pots with strawberries and hens and chicks in my garage in the city when I was there, and I lucked out. They did make it, but I always worry about a clay pot exposed to really cold temperatures not making it through. So it depends on how expensive that clay pot is and how much effort you want to put in. But those would be some options, too.
Thank you, Janet, for calling. Mark in Green Bay, your turn now. Hi, Mark.
Hi. My name's Mark. I 2 years ago, I bought some raspberry bushes from the farmer's market, and obviously the first year I didn't get anything. This year I didn't get any berries from them, but they really grew quite a bit with a southeast view inside the garage. What do I do for the winter now? Should I put some fertilizer and mulch on them, give them a good start in the spring? I'm hoping that maybe this next year I'll finally get some berries.
You know, great question, Mark, and I'm glad you brought up raspberries. UW Extension has an excellent publication, Growing Raspberries in Wisconsin, available to download for free. Not that Extension needs our support, but we always want the answers immediately. And I usually end up doing it the lame way, UW Extension, Growing Raspberries in Wisconsin, and it gets me to the Learning Store. And the reason I recommend that is raspberries, fall-bearing raspberries, and I'm doing kind of the whole spiel, Mark, so stay with me for everybody's benefit. They flower and fruit on first-year canes, so those canes that come up out of the ground. Summer-bearing raspberries, those canes, and that's what I think you were expecting, go through winter, and in the second year of their life, they flower and form fruit, and then they're done. And so we usually prune those out after they've formed fruit or should have formed fruit. We want to leave them stand for winter because your raspberries form most of their fruit from 2 feet to the tips. Then in late winter, you can do your thinning, you know, get rid of anything you should have removed in the summer, and thinning them out to about 4 or 5 per foot of row. And that way you get more light penetration, better airflow, fewer diseases, better fruit production, and wait until spring to do any fertilizing. Raspberries are pretty tough plants. They don't need a lot of fertilization, but again, doing it in the spring, maybe a slow-release, low-nitrogen-type fertilizer. Some people use age manure, things like that. And then hopefully you'll have better luck. Sometimes when we're establishing new plants, they spend the first couple of years putting down roots, and raspberries put down a lot of roots in underground stems, right, called rhizomes. And so they're pretty vigorous, and that's why you don't want to give them too much food to keep them going anymore. So I would get that publication because there's a good graphic. You know, when I explain this, I always think, oh, when people hang up, did they understand what I was trying to explain? Just because it's a little confusing. So check out that publication. Leave things stand for the winter as long as they're healthy. Do your pruning and thinning in late winter once we hopefully see the end of winter damage and animals eating on those raspberries. And then you should be in good shape for next summer to have a harvest.
Thank you, Mark, for calling. Appreciate it. Amy in Milwaukee emailed to say she wants to move a hydrangea plant. It's the smaller pink one, not the traditional large white hydrangeas. Can she still move it now, or should she wait? She's in Milwaukee.
So, Amy, if it's the pink-forming Annabelle type, like Invincible Spirit 2 or Incredible Blush, those are pretty tough and hardy. If it's the pink flowering big leaf hydrangea, like an Endless Summer or summer crush, they tend to be a little less hardy. They're supposedly zone 4 hardy. They bloom on old and new growth. I would probably wait till spring to move those if it's one of the big leaf type hydrangeas. This past Wednesday and the previous Wednesday, my two webinars were on hydrangeas. And so I talk about selection and care in the first one, and that must have been the 21st. And then on the 28th, I talk about problems with hydrangeas. And the handout talks a lot about pruning and planting and care and selection. So for the hydrangeas must be my number one question. If I mention hydrangeas, boy, I get a lot of questions. So you might want to check those out, Amy. But if it's the big leaf type, like an endless summer, I would probably wait till spring. And if it's the Annabelle type that has pink flowers, you could do it as soon as possible now or in spring before growth begins. They're hardy to like zone 4, 3 or 4, so they're pretty tough and resilient. But the big leaf types in our area, I would wait. So you need to know which one you're dealing with. But if it's pink in alkaline soil, blue in acid soil, if that's what they told you, it's a big leaf type.
Tim in Kalamazoo, Michigan, emailed to ask if there's any concern about using pine needles as compost and adding too much acidity to his garden soil or compost pile. Should he add some lime or acid buffer in the spring?
Great question, Tim. I'm so glad you asked. Pine needles have minimal impact, or evergreen needles in general, on our soil pH. So those of us with alkaline soil wish they had more. They make a great mulch. I use evergreen needles as a mulch just by themselves. In your compost pile, the composting process tends to be acidic anyway, but lime has long-term implications and impact on our soil pH. So I'm always hesitant to ever recommend lime, even to people with acidic soil, until you have your soil tested, because the soil test will tell you how much, if any, lime you need. So pine needles are great as a mulch on their own. They're slow to break down. They're wonderful. They're pretty to look at. They're excellent in the compost pile. You may find, I've used them in my lasagna garden, and what I find is they last for years. Everything else breaks down, but it doesn't impact the growth of my plants I'm growing in those beds. So no problem with soil acidity. They do their job. You know, if you look under an evergreen, besides the shade from the evergreen's canopy, those pine needles block the light in the soil, and they work well as a mulch. So it's a great option.
Well, one final thing. Bart emailed that he uses a gator blade, mulching blade, in the fall and shreds the leaves into finer dust-like pieces and with fewer passes, he's discovered. And he's been doing this professionally for 26 years. So that's one final comment on getting those leaves mulched.
Exactly.
Melinda.
And I'm sorry for my loud cat here. But no, and that's what I appreciate about your listeners, Larry. They're always wonderful. Gardeners are the best sharers of advice, information, and plant material. So thank you, Bart, for that last bit of wisdom.
And Melinda, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I can't wait for our next visit. Thank you.
Me either. You take care. Thanks so much.
Melinda Myers, our guest. Take a look at her website. Don't forget she has those free gardening webinars coming up and some already finished that you can see. You can go to WPR.org/Larry and look in the notes section and you'll find that information there. Thank you so much for listening. Jeff Epping from Olbrich Botanical Gardens joins us next Friday for Garden Talk. But now, in the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.